الشعب السوري ما بينزل. بيان رقم واحد أكيد هيك ما حنضلها. بيان رقم واحد من حرام بلشت البشاير. بيان رقم واحد للشعب السوري ساير.
I'm speaking with Dr. Moraf Juajati. He's a Syrian-born specialist on Middle Eastern affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He's currently a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. Dr. Juajati is also a professorial lecturer in political science and international affairs at George Washington University, as well as a scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Juajati.
Thank you very much.
Clearly, the regime in Syria has been under sustained threats from its own people, and it has met the protests of the people who want freedom and democracy and dignity, I think is the word that keeps coming up, with unbelievable brutality, and that seems to be culminating now in the little town on the north near the Turkish border. What's your understanding of the extent to which these mutinies in the army are either widespread or perhaps even growing?
Growing, certainly, not widespread. They did start early on when the army took on the protesters in the south of Syria in the city of Daraa. We did have a few defections. These defections were by lower-ranking soldiers and what have you. But as the protests have grown and as they become more widespread and the army was called upon in different localities to put down this uprising, there has been more and more defections, and the rank has grown. So now it is not only soldiers. What is interesting about what has happened in the past 2 days in the town of Jisr al-Shughur is that apparently units of the army and the security services have turned on themselves and have taken shots at each other. And this may be at least a part explanation of the 120 soldiers that have been killed in the past 2 days.
Well, can you give us an idea of how the army is structured? Is it structured along the lines of the way Stalin set up the Red Army with commissars? You have political and security officers that keep an eye on the professional military. I take it that the real villain in this piece is the younger brother of Bashar al-Assad, Maha al-Assad, who controls both the Republican Guards and he commands the 4th Armored Division.
That's correct. He commands both. These are the most important striking forces of the Syrian army. He, of course, did not structure the Syrian army this way. This goes back to his dad and the dad of Bashar al-Assad, Hafez al-Assad, who had structured the army. The Syrian army differs, for example, from the Egyptian and Tunisian armies in that it is not a semi-autonomous or autonomous institution. Rather, this is an appendage to the security forces of the state. And the major striking forces are dominated by officers that are of the same ethnic group and clan as of the Assad family. So that in the end, the Syrian army, at least at the top echelons, is far more loyal to the dominance of the Assads than the Egyptian or Tunisian armies had been to their chiefs of state.
Well, just to give our audience a sense of the family dynamics in this family dictatorship in which the current holder, of course, inherited the dictatorship. He was not the anointed one, but the anointed one died in a car accident. My understanding is that Maha al-Assad is a little bit like Saddam Hussein's sons. He's a psychotic and a dangerous individual and extremely brutal. And he actually allegedly shot and wounded his brother-in-law, Asaf Chokat, who is the deputy chief of staff of the Syrian army.
Maha al-Assad does have a reputation of being a violent man. But again, the violence that we are seeing in Syria, of course, it can be in a major part attributed to Maher al-Assad, who is dominating those security forces. But this is an instinct. This is a reflex of an authoritarian regime that is minoritarian and that has led Syria for the past four decades and more And so, therefore, you know, there is a sentiment that Syria belongs to the Assad family and nobody shall take it away, and that they will use as much force as is necessary for any attempt to take it away from them. So you're right, Maher al-Assad is a violent character. He is said to have shot his brother-in-law in the stomach. He does command these striking forces that have shown themselves beyond brutal, really merciless. But again, this is part and parcel of a culture of an authoritarian regime that seeks to survive at any cost.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Murhaf Juajati, who is a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He's currently a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. Now, this does seem to be something of a repeat of history, these family dynamics between the dictator and his brother. After all, back in 1980, Hafez al-Assad's brother, Rifat, was the one who went ahead and did the massacre in Hama, where up to 20,000 people died. He, by the way, Rifat, is living in London, is he not?
Rifat al-Assad is, in fact, and indeed in exile. He himself tried to make a coup against his late brother Hafez al-Assad when al-Assad was president, and that is why he is in exile, and he has been prohibited from returning ever since. He himself still has political ambitions, and he is one source of opposition to his nephew, Bashar al-Assad, who is now president. But you're right, there is a symmetry in the relationship between Hafez al-Assad, who was seen as the strategist, as the conciliator, as the arbitrator of rival factions in the state, and Rifat al-Assad, who terrifies people, really had a very, very terrifying reputation. And now we see the same role distribution, really, in the family. Bashar al-Assad being the man to come up with the conciliatory gestures or to come up with some attempts at reform, and Maher al-Assad being the bad cop and the man who terrifies the people and deters them from seeking freedom.
So let's turn to the military then. And my understanding is that military officers in the Syrian army with a conscience, or even lower ranking enlisted soldiers, have a terrible dilemma. They have a choice between killing their own fellow Syrians or being killed by the security services within the that watch over the army. There was a very brave lieutenant, Abdul Razak Tlas, from the town of Rastan, who appeared just recently on Al Jazeera television, a junior Syrian officer calling upon his comrades to refuse to continue massacring their fellow Syrians. I don't know what his fate is, but give us a sense of whether this could be a growing phenomenon and eventually led to the downfall of this Alawite clique that run the country.
Well, Ian, you mentioned Lieutenant Tlas, who has recently defected. This, of course, one lieutenant is not enough for us to talk about causing the final collapse of the Assad regime. But what is very significant about this young man in particular is that he comes from the Tlas family. And the former Minister of Defense under Hafez al-Assad for over 30 years was General Tlas. So it is the same family from the same town of Al-Rastan, which leads me to believe that there is the development of schisms at the elite level. If that is true, and if that trend continues, then certainly the Assad regime is in very much trouble, but not only the Assad regime, but because this could throw Syria into a civil war if we have army units that are poised against Bashar al-Assad and others that would want to defend his regime.
Well, what do you think, though, would take to stimulate the consciences of more military officers and perhaps generals? Is there any outside pressure? I know at this point the British and the French have circulated a draft to condemn the Assad regime. The Russians and the Chinese apparently have resisted it, but it seems to be getting closer to being voted on in the Security Council. What kind of outside pressure is going to work? Is there, are they in any way subject to moral sanctions?
You're absolutely right about the international pressures not yet working because of the fragmentation of the international community, and the Assad regime is betting on that, is betting on the fact that the Security Council will not be able to condemn Syria, and even if it did, it will not have a mandate for states to intervene in Syria. So unless the international community has some sort of a consensus, the Assad regime is undeterred. It will be deterred if there is such a consensus, but such a consensus, of course, is not sufficient in and by itself. It has to coincide, I think, with a unity of ranks in the domestic opposition, so that the Assad regime would be facing a massive rebellion in its domestic ranks while being totally isolated internationally. And it is this pincer movement, I would believe, that would then force the collapse of the Assad regime.
And a lot of analysts have been critical of President Obama for not speaking out and condemning them in the way that he did with Muammar Gaddafi. My sense is that maybe that would backfire, because the regime is trying to say that this rebellion is stimulated and financed and manipulated by the Israelis and by the Americans. That would probably play into his hands, but maybe at this point it's time for somebody to take a stand. What's your feeling?
Well, the Obama administration has been hesitant. It has invested actually quite a lot diplomatically in a policy of engagement with Assad. At the time, this policy seemed right because the United States was trying to wean Syria away from Iran. This policy, of course, can no longer hold. And here we have before us an Assad regime that is massacring its own citizens. And so, as the leader of the free world, one would think that the United States would be ahead of all the pack of states that would not only condemn Syria, but would delegitimize the Assad regime. Now, we have to take into account the fact that Syria has a very important geostrategic position, and that states should also think of the consequences of the collapse of the Assad regime and the implications and repercussions that this would have, not only on the Arab-Israeli conflict, of which Syria is part, but also on the regional level as well, with all the implications of a spillover in sectarianism and what have you. And so, you know, if I were in the shoes of President Obama, I too would hesitate. The United States is in Iraq, it is in Afghanistan, it is now involved in Libya, and I don't know that American public opinion has the stomach for the United States to go after yet one more country. But the administration has escalated not only its rhetoric against Damascus, but has imposed further sanctions and some targeted sanctions against the regime, senior regime officials, which in the end do hurt.
Well, just in closing then, Dr. Djoujati, what about some of the tricks that are still up Assad's sleeves? He's trying to use the Palestinians as a way to distract attention from his brutality against his own people. And the government newspaper, Tishrin, is now suggesting that 600,000 Palestinians may soon try to go home to the land of Palestine. And I'm just not sure that the Israelis are being particularly subtle about, you know, nonviolent methods to stop people crossing the Golan Heights. That's clearly what Assad's trying to do, isn't it? He wants to create an incident on that border with the Israelis to distract attention from what's happening at home.
I'm not sure I agree that he wants to distract attention, because nothing can distract attention, really, from massacres that are taking place in Syria daily and that are documented by clips, video clips that are taken by folks on the ground and distributed internationally. I think rather Assad is sending the message both to Washington and to Israel that if they are going to further destabilize his regime, then he can destabilize the Syrian-Israeli border with major consequences for the region, you know, something leading to an Arab-Israeli war. So it's not so much to divert domestic attention as much as to say, if you destabilize me, I'm going to destabilize the hell out of you. And this is what we are seeing, I think, across the Golan Heights. And it is truly a very, very dangerous situation.
But what does that say about the Palestinians? Are they that easy to manipulate?
They're not easy to manipulate. And in fact, yesterday in Damascus, or near Damascus in the Yarmouk refugee camp, many Palestinian refugees attacked the headquarters of the PFLP General Command because the leader, Ahmad Jibril, in order to support the Assad regime, sent those Palestinians to the front. And as a result, the refugees in the Yarmouk refugee camp assaulted the headquarters, burned it down, and nearly killed Ahmad Jibril. But on the other hand, of course, this is a very emotional issue for most Palestinians, and once they get the chance to be to have an opening, whatever that opening is, to return to their homeland, they of course will use it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Mouraf Jouajati.
Thank you very much.
Again, I was speaking with Dr. Mouraf Jouajati, who is a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Mazi Bihari, who was jailed by the Iranian regime and lived to tell his tale.